Leaving. Reese was sorting through books in the dining room, but I could still see her scowl. I looked away out of habit. The last thing I needed was Reese reading everything that had happened last night in my face. Not until Sunday, but Lena hasn't even packed. Don't distract her, Reese called out. 2 days. She was leaving in 2 days. And I didn't know. Was she even planning to say goodbye? I ducked my head and stepped into the parlor to say hi to Grandma. She was an immovable force sitting in her rocking chair with a cup of tea and the paper, as if the bustle of the morning didn't apply to her. She smiled, folding the paper in half. I had assumed it was the Stars and Stripes, but it was written in a language I didn't recognize.
Ethan, I wish you could come with us. I will miss you, and I'm sure Lena will be counting the days until we get back.
She rose from the chair and hugged me. Lena might be counting the days, but not for the reason Grandma thought. Her family had no idea what was going on with us anymore, or with Lena for that matter. I had a feeling they didn't know she was hanging out in underground caster clubs like Exile, or hitching rides on the back of John's Harley. Maybe they didn't know about John Breed at all. I remembered when I first met Lena. The long list of the places she'd lived, the friends she had never made, the schools she'd never been able to go to. I wondered if she was going back to a life like that. Grandma was staring at me curiously. She put her hand on my cheek. It was soft, like the gloves the sisters wore to church.
You've changed, Ethan.
Ma'am?
I can't quite put my finger on it. But something's different.
I looked away. There was no point in pretending. She would sense that Lena and I were no longer connected, if she hadn't already. Grandma was like Amma. She was usually the strongest person in the room by sheer force of will alone. I'm not the one who changed, ma'am. She sat down again, picking her newspaper back up.
Nonsense. Everyone changes, Ethan. That's life. Now go tell my granddaughter to get packing. We need to go before the tides change and we're marooned here forever.
She smiled as if I was in on the joke. Only I wasn't. Lena's door was open just a crack. The walls, the ceiling, the furniture, everything was black. Her walls weren't covered in Sharpie anymore. Now her poetry was scrawled in white chalk. Her closet doors were covered with the same phrase over and over. Running to stand still, running to stand still, running to stand still. I stared at the words, separating them the way I often had to when it came to Lena's writing. Once I did, I recognized them from an old U2 song and realized how true they really were. It's what Lena had been doing all this time, every second since Macon died. Her little cousin Ryan was sitting on the bed, holding Lena's face in her hands. Ryan was a thaumaturge and only used her healing powers when someone was in great pain. Usually it was me, but today it was Lena. I barely recognized her. She looked like she hadn't slept last night. She was wearing an oversized, faded black t-shirt as a nightgown. Her hair was tangled, her eyes red and swollen.
Ethan!
The minute Ryan saw me, she was a regular kid again. She jumped into my arms, and I picked her up, swinging her legs from side to side.
Why aren't you coming with us? It's going to be so boring. Reese is going to boss me around the whole summer, and Lena isn't any fun either.
I have to stick around here and take care of Amma and my dad, Chicken Little.
I put Ryan down gently. Lena looked annoyed. She sat down on her unmade bed with her legs folded under her and waved Ryan out of the room. Out now,
Please.
Ryan made a face.
If you two do anything disgusting and you need me, I'll be downstairs.
Ryan had saved my life on more than one occasion when Lena and I had gone too far and the electrical current between us had nearly stopped my heart. Lena would never have that problem with John Breed. I wondered if it was his shirt she was wearing.
What are you doing here, Ethan?
Lena stared up at the ceiling, and I followed her eyes to the words on the walls. I couldn't look at her. When you look up, do you see the blue sky of what might be, or the darkness of what will never be? Do you see me? I want to talk about last night.
You mean about why you were following me?
Her voice was harsh, which pissed me off. I wasn't following you. I was looking for you because I was worried. But I can see how that would be inconvenient when you were busy hooking up with John.
Lena's jaw tightened, and she stood up, the t-shirt grazing her knees.
John and I are just friends. We weren't hooking up.
Do you hang all over all your friends like that?
Lena stepped closer to me, the ends of her ratty curls beginning to lift gently off her shoulders. The chandelier hanging from the center of her ceiling began to sway.
Do you try to kiss all of yours?
She looked me right in the eye. There was a flash of light and sparks, then darkness. The light bulbs on the chandelier exploded, tiny shards raining down on her bed. I heard the patter of rain on the roof.
What are you...
Don't bother lying, Ethan. I know what you and your library partner were doing outside exile. The voice in my head was sharp and bitter.
I heard you. You were Kelting. Blue eyes and blonde hair. Sound familiar?
She was right. I was Kelting, and she'd heard every word.
Nothing happened.
The chandelier crashed onto her bed, missing me by inches. The floor seemed to drop out from under me. She'd heard me.
Nothing happened? Did you think I wouldn't know? Did you think I wouldn't feel it?
It was worse than looking Reese in the eye. Lena could see everything, and she didn't need her powers to do it.
I lost it when I saw you with that guy John, and I wasn't thinking.
You can tell yourself that, but everything happens for a reason. You almost kissed her, and you did it because you wanted to.
Maybe I just wanted to piss you off, because I saw you with another guy. Be careful what you wish for.
I searched her face, the dark circles around her eyes, the sadness. The green eyes I loved so much were gone, changed into the golden eyes of a dark caster.
What are you doing with me, Ethan?
I don't know anymore. Lena's face fell for a second, but she caught herself.
You've been dying to get that out, haven't you? Now you can run off with your little mortal girlfriend, guilt-free.
She said mortal as if she could hardly stand to say the word.
I bet you can't wait to hang out at the lake with her.
Lena was seething. Whole sections of ceiling were beginning to cave where the chandelier had fallen. Whatever pain she might have been feeling was totally eclipsed by her anger.
You'll be back on the basketball team by the time school starts, and she can join the cheer squad. Emily and Savannah will love her.
I heard a cracking sound, and another stretch of drywall smashed to the ground next to me. My chest tightened. Lena was wrong, but I couldn't help but think about how easy it would be to date a regular girl, a mortal girl.
I always knew that's what you wanted. Now you can have it.
Another crash. Now I was covered with the fine white dust of her fallen ceiling, broken chunks scattered on the floor around me. She was fighting back tears.
That's not what I meant, and you know it. Do I? All I know is that it shouldn't be so hard. Loving someone shouldn't be so hard. I never cared about that.
I felt her fading away, pushing me out of her mind and out of her heart. You belong with someone like you, and I belong with someone like me, someone who understands what I'm going through. I'm not the same person I was a few months ago, but I guess we both know that.
Why can't you stop punishing yourself, Lena? It wasn't your fault. You couldn't have saved him. You don't know what you're talking about. I know you think it's your fault your uncle's dead, and that torturing yourself is some kind of penance. There's no penance for what I did.
She started to turn away.
Don't run away. I'm not running. I'm already gone.
I could barely hear her voice in my head. I moved closer to her. It didn't matter what she'd done or if things between us were over. I couldn't watch her destroy herself. I pulled her to my chest and wrapped my arms around her like she was drowning, and I just wanted to get her out of the water. I could feel every inch of her burning cold against me. Her fingertips brushed mine. My chest was numb where her face pressed into it.
It doesn't matter if we're together or not. You're not one of them, Elle. I'm not one of you, either.
Her last words were a whisper. I tangled my hands into her hair. There was no part of me that could let go. I think she was crying, but I couldn't tell for sure. As I watched the ceiling, the last bits of plaster around the hole began to splinter into a thousand fissures, as if the rest of the roof might fall in on us any minute.
So this is it?
It was, but I didn't want her to answer. I wanted to stay in this moment for a little while longer. I wanted to hold on to her and pretend she was still mine to hold.
My family leaves in 2 days. By the time they wake up tomorrow, I'll be gone. Elle, you can't.
She touched my mouth.
If you ever loved me, and I know you did, leave it alone. I'm not going to let any more people I care about die because of me. Lena, this is my curse. It's mine. Let me have it.
What if I say no? She looked at me, her whole face darkening into a single shadow.
You don't have a choice.
If you come by Ravenwood tomorrow, I can guarantee you won't feel like talking. And you won't be able to, either.
Are you saying you're going to put a cast on me?
It was an unspoken line between us she had never crossed. She smiled and put her finger over my lips.
Silentium, Latin for silence, which is what you'll hear if you try to tell anyone I'm leaving before I go. You wouldn't.
I just did.
Finally, here we were.
The only thing left between us was the unimaginable power she had never used against me. Her eyes flared gold and bright. There wasn't a trace of green. I knew she meant every word.
Swear you won't come back here.
Lena slipped out of my arms and turned away from me. She didn't want to show me her eyes anymore, and I couldn't stand to see them.
I swear.
She didn't say a word. She nodded and wiped the tears running down her face. By the time I walked away, it was raining plaster. I walked through the halls of Ravenwood one last time. The house grew darker and darker the farther I went. Lena was going. Macon was gone. Everyone was leaving and the house felt dead. I dragged my fingers along the polished mahogany banister. I wanted to remember the smell of the varnish, the smooth feel of the old wood. Maybe the faintest smell of Macon's imported cigars, Confederate jasmine, blood oranges, and books. I stopped in front of Macon's bedroom door. Painted a flat black, it could have been any door in the house. But it wasn't any door, and Boo was sleeping in front of it, waiting for a master who was never coming home. He didn't look like a wolf anymore, just a regular dog. Without Macon, he was as lost as Lena. Boo looked up at me, barely moving his head. I put my hand on the doorknob and pushed the door open. Macon's room was exactly as I remembered. No one had dared to put a sheet over anything in here. The ebony four-poster bed in the center of the room shined as if it had been lacquered 1,000 times by house or kitchen, Ravenwood's invisible staff. Black plantation shutters kept the room completely dark, so it was impossible to tell day from night. Tall candlesticks held black candles, and a black wrought-iron chandelier hung from the ceiling. I recognized the castor pattern burned into the iron. At first, I couldn't place it, but then I remembered. I had seen it on Ridley and John Breed and at Exile. The mark of a dark caster, the tattoo they all shared. Each one looked different, yet unmistakably similar. More like a brand than a tattoo, as if it had been burned into them rather than inked. I shuddered and picked up a small object from the top of a black dresser. It was a framed photograph of Macon and a woman. I could see Macon standing next to her, but it was dark, and I could only make out the outline of her silhouette, a shadow caught on film. I wondered if it was Jane. How many secrets had Macon carried to his grave? I tried to put the frame back, but it was so dark I misjudged the distance and the picture fell. When I bent to pick it up, I noticed the corner of the rug was flipped back. It looked exactly like the rug I had seen in Macon's room in the tunnels. I lifted up the rug, and underneath there was a perfect rectangle cut into the floorboards, big enough for a man. It was another door into the tunnels. I yanked on the floorboard, and it came loose. I could see down into Macon's study, but there were no stairs, and the stone floor looked too far down to jump without risking serious head trauma. I remembered the cloaked door to the Lunae Libri. There was no way to find out, except to try. I held on to the edge of the bed and stepped down carefully. I stumbled for a second, then felt something solid under my foot. A step. Though I couldn't see it, I could feel the splintery wooden stair under my feet. Seconds later, I was standing on the stone floor of Macon's study. He didn't spend all of his days sleeping. He spent them in the tunnels, probably with Marion. I could picture the two of them looking up obscure old castor legends, debating antebellum garden formations, having tea. She had probably spent more time with Macon than anyone, except Lena. I wondered if Marion was the woman in the picture, and her name was really Jane. I hadn't considered it before, but it would explain a lot of things. Why the countless brown library packages were kept neatly piled in Macon's study, why a Duke professor would be hiding out as a librarian, even as a keeper, in a town like Gatlin, why Marion and Macon were inseparable so much of the time, at least for a reclusive incubus who didn't go anywhere. Maybe they had loved each other all these years. I looked around the room until I saw it, the wooden box that held Macon's thoughts and secrets. It was on the shelf where Marion had left it. I closed my eyes and reached for it. It was the thing Macon wanted least and most, to see Jane one last time. It had been weeks since he'd seen her, unless you counted the nights he had followed her home from the library, watching her from a distance, wishing he could touch her. Not now. Not when the transformation was so close. But she was here, even though he told her to stay away. Jane, you have to get out of here. It's not safe. She walked slowly across the room to where he was standing. Don't you understand? I can't stay away. I know. He drew her to him and kissed her one last time. Macon took something out of a small box in the back of his closet. He put the object in Jane's hand, closing her fingers around it. It was round and smooth, a perfect sphere. He closed his hand around hers, his voice grave. I can't protect you after the transformation, not from the one thing that poses the greatest threat to your safety. Me. Macon looked down at their hands, gently cradling the object he had hidden so carefully. If something happens, and you're in danger, use this. Jane opened her hand. The sphere was black and opalescent, like a pearl. But as she watched, the sphere began to change and glow. She could feel the buzz of tiny vibrations emanating from it. What is it? Macon stepped back, as if he didn't want to touch the orb now that it had come to life. It's an arc light. What is it for? If the time comes when I become a danger to you, you'll be defenseless. There's no way you will be able to kill me or hurt me. Only another incubus can do that. Jane's eyes clouded over. Her voice was a whisper. I could never hurt you. Macon reached out and touched her face tenderly. I know, but even if you wanted to, it would be impossible. A mortal cannot kill an incubus. That's why you need the arc light. It's the only thing that can contain my kind. The only way you would be able to stop me if... What do you mean, contain? Macon turned away. It's like a cage, Jane. The only cage that can hold us. Jane looked down at the dark orb glowing in her palm. Now that she knew what it was, it felt as if it was burning a hole in her hand and her heart. She dropped it on his desk and it rolled across the tabletop, its glow fading to black. You think I'm going to imprison you in that thing like an animal? I'll be worse than an animal. Tears ran down Jane's face and over her lips. She grabbed Macon's arm, forcing him to face her. How long would you be in there? Most likely, forever. She shook her head. I won't do it. I would never condemn you to that. It looked as if tears were welling up in Macon's eyes, even though Jane knew it was impossible. He had no tears to shed, yet she swore she could see them glistening. If something happened to you, if I hurt you, you would be condemning me to a fate, an eternity, far worse than anything I would find in here. Macon picked up the arc light and held it up between them. If the time comes and you have to use it, you have to promise me you will. Jane choked back her tears, her voice shaking. I don't know if I... Macon rested his forehead against hers. Promise me, Janie. If you love me, promise me. Jane buried her face in his cool neck. She took a deep breath. I promise. Macon raised his head and looked over her shoulder. A promise is a promise, Ethan. I woke up lying on a bed. There was light streaming in a window, so I knew I wasn't in Macon's study anymore. I stared at the ceiling, but there was no crazy black chandelier, so I wasn't in his room at Ravenwood either. I sat up, groggy and confused. I was in my own bed, in my room. The window was open, and the morning light was shining into my eyes. How could I have passed out there and ended up here, hours later? What had happened to space and time and all the physics in between? What caster or incubus was powerful enough to do that? The visions had never affected me like this before. Both Abraham and Macon had seen me. How was that possible? What was Macon trying to tell me? Why did he want me to see these visions? I couldn't put it together, except for one thing. Either the visions were changing, or I was. Lena had made sure of that. June 17th. Inheritance. I stayed away from Ravenwood, like I promised. By morning, I didn't know where Lena was or where she was headed. I wondered if John and Ridley were with her. The only thing I knew was Lena had waited all her life to take charge of her own destiny, to find a way to claim herself, in spite of the curse. I wasn't going to be the person to stand in her way now. And, as she pointed out, she wasn't going to let me. Which left me with my own immediate destiny, to stay in bed all day feeling sorry for myself. Me and some comic books, anything but Aquaman. Gatlin had planned otherwise. The county fair meant a day of pageants and pies and a night of hooking up, if you were lucky. All Souls meant something else entirely. It was a tradition in Gatlin. Instead of spending the day in shorts and flip-flops at the fair, everyone in town spent all day at the graveyard in their Sunday best, paying their respects to their dead relatives and everyone else's. Forget the fact that All Souls Day was actually a Catholic holiday that took place in November. In Gatlin, we had our own way of doing things. So we turned it into our own day of remembrance, guilt, and general competition over who could pile the most plastic flowers and angels on our ancestors' graves. Everyone turned out on All Souls, the Baptists, the Methodists, even the Evangelicals and the Pentecostals. It used to be that the only two people in town who didn't show up at the cemetery were Amma, who spent All Souls at her own family plot in Waiter's Creek, and Macon Ravenwood. I wondered if those two had ever spent All Souls together, in the swamp with the Greats. I doubted it. I couldn't imagine Macon or the Greats appreciating plastic flowers. I wondered if the casters had their own version of All Souls, if Lena was somewhere feeling the same way I was feeling now, like she wanted to crawl back into bed and hide until the day was over. Last year, I didn't make it to All Souls. It was too soon. The years before that, I spent the day standing over the graves of waits I never knew or barely remembered. But today, I would be standing over the grave of someone I thought about every day. My mother. Amma was in the kitchen in her good white blouse, the one with the lace collar, and her long blue skirt. She was clutching one of those tiny old lady pocketbooks. "You best get on over to your aunt's." She pulled on the knot of my tie to straighten it. "You know how they get all worked up if you're late." "Yes, ma'am." I grabbed the keys to my dad's car off the counter. I had dropped him off at the gates of his garden of perpetual peace an hour ago. He wanted to spend some time alone with my mom. "Wait a second." I froze. I didn't want Amma to look into my eyes. I couldn't talk about Lena right now, and I didn't want her to try to get it out of me. Amma rifled through her bag, pulling out something I couldn't see. She opened my hand, and the chain dropped into my palm. It was thin and gold, with a tiny bird hanging from the center. It was much smaller than the ones from Macon's funeral, but I recognized it right away. "It's a sparrow for your mama." Amma's eyes were shiny, like the road after the rain. "To casters, sparrows mean freedom, but to a seer, they mean a safe journey. Sparrows are clever. They can travel a long ways, but they always find their way back home." The knot was building in my throat. I don't think my mom will be making any more journeys. Amma wiped her eyes and snapped her purse shut. "Well, you're mighty sure of everything, aren't you, Ethan Waite?" When I pulled up the sister's gravel driveway and opened the car door, Lucille sat on the passenger seat instead of jumping out. She knew where we were, and she knew she'd been exiled. I coaxed her out of the car, but she sat on the sidewalk where the cement and the grass met. Thelma opened the door before I knocked. She looked right past me to the cat, crossing her arms. "Hey there, Lucille." Lucille licked her paw lazily, then busied herself with sniffing her tail. She might as well have flipped Thelma off. "You coming by to say you like Amma's biscuits better'n mine?" Lucille was the only cat I knew who ate biscuits and gravy instead of cat food. She meowed as if she had a few choice words on the subject. Thelma turned to me. "Hey there, sweetmeat. I heard you pull up." She kissed me on the cheek, which always left bright pink lip prints no amount of sweaty palm could wipe off. "Y'all right?" Everyone knew today wasn't going to be easy for me. "Yeah, I'm okay. Are the sisters ready?" Thelma put her hand on her hip. "Have those girls ever been ready for anything in their lives?" Thelma always called the sisters girls, even though they were older than her, twice over. A voice called from the living room.
"Ethan, is that you? We need you to take a look at something."
There was no telling what that meant. They could be making casts out of the Stars and Stripes for a family of raccoons, or planning Aunt Prue's fourth, or was it fifth, wedding. Of course, there was a third possibility I hadn't considered, and it involved me.
"Come on in."
Aunt Grace waved me in.
"Mercy, give him some of them blue stickers."
She was fanning herself with an old church program, most likely from one of their respective husbands' funerals. Since the sisters never let anyone actually keep one at the service, they had plenty of them lying around the house.
"I'd get 'em for you myself, but I have to be careful on account of my accident. I've got complications."
It was the only thing she talked about since the county fair. Half the town knew she had fainted, but to hear Aunt Grace tell it, she had suffered a near-fatal complication that would keep Thelma, Aunt Prue, and Aunt Mercy scurrying to do her bidding until the end of her days.
"No, no. Ethan's color's red, I told you. Give him the red ones."
Aunt Prue was scribbling madly on a yellow legal pad. Aunt Mercy handed me a sheet of stickers with red dots on them.
"Now, Ethan, go round the living room and put one of these stickers underneath of the things you want. Go on now."
She stared at me expectantly, as if she would be offended if I didn't slap one of them on her forehead. "What are you talking about, Aunt Mercy?" Aunt Grace pulled a framed photo of an old guy in a Confederate uniform off the wall.
"This here's General Robert Charles Tyler, last rebel general killed in the war between the states. Give me one of them stickers. This here'll be worth something."
I had no idea what they were into and was afraid to ask. "We have to get going. Did you forget it was All Souls?" Aunt Prue frowned.
Course we didn't forget. That's why we're getting our affairs in order. That's what the stickers are for. Everyone's got a color. Thelma's yellow, you're red, your daddy's blue.
Aunt Mercy paused as if she had lost her train of thought. Aunt Prue silenced her with a look. She didn't like being interrupted.
You put those little stickers on the bottom of the things you want. That way, when we die, Thelma'll know exactly who gets what. It was on account of All Souls that we got to thinking about it.
Aunt Grace smiled proudly.
I don't want anything, and none of you are dying.
I dropped the sheet of stickers on the table.
Ethan, Wade'll be here next month, and he's just as greedy as a fox in a hen house. You need to do your choosing first.
Wade was my Uncle Landis's illegitimate son, another person in my family who would never make it onto the Waite family tree. There was really no point in arguing with the sisters when they got like this, so I spent the next half hour putting little red stickers underneath unmatched dining room chairs and Civil War memorabilia, but I still had time to kill while I waited for the sisters to pick out their hats for All Souls. Choosing the right hat was serious business, and most of the ladies in town had already been down to Charleston to do their shopping weeks ago. To see them walking up the hill wearing everything from peacock feathers to freshly cut roses on their heads, you would think the ladies of Gatlin were going to a garden party instead of a graveyard. The place was a mess. Aunt Prue must have made Thelma drag down every box from the attic, full of old clothes, quilts, and photo albums. I flipped through the pages of the album on top. Old pictures were taped onto the brown pages. Aunt Prue and her husband's, Aunt Mercy standing in front of her old house on Dove Street, my house, Waite's Landing, back when my granddad was a kid. I turned the last page, and another house stared back at me. Ravenwood Manor. But not the Ravenwood I knew. This was a Ravenwood fit for the Historical Society Registry. Cypress trees lined the walk leading up to the crisp white veranda. Every pillar, every shutter was freshly painted. There were no traces of the strangling overgrowth, the crooked stairs of Macon's Ravenwood. Underneath the photo, there was an inscription, carefully added in delicate handwriting. Ravenwood Manor, 1865. I was staring at Abraham's Ravenwood.
What you got there?
Aunt Mercy shuffled in wearing the biggest, pinkest flamingo of a hat I'd ever seen. There was some kind of weird netting on the front, like a veil, topped with a very unrealistic bird perched in a pink nest. When she moved the slightest bit, the whole thing kind of flapped, as if it could fly right off her head. No, this wouldn't give Savannah and the cheer squad any ammo. I tried not to look at the flapping bird. It's an old photo album. It was sitting on the top of this box. I handed the album to her.
Prudence, Jane, bring me my spectacles.
There was some banging around in the hall, and Aunt Prue appeared in the doorway in an equally large and disturbing hat. This one was black, with a wraparound veil that made Aunt Prue look like the mother of a mob boss at his funeral.
If you wore them round your neck, like I told you...
Either Aunt Mercy had her hearing aid turned down, or she was ignoring Aunt Prue.
Look what Ethan found.
The book was still open to the same page. The Ravenwood of the past stared back at us.
Lord have mercy. Look at that. The devil's workshop if I ever saw it.
The sisters and most of the old folks in Gatlin were convinced Abraham Ravenwood made some kind of deal with the devil to save Ravenwood Plantation from General Sherman's burning campaign of 1865, which had left every other plantation along the river in ashes. If the sisters only knew how close it was to the truth.
"Ain't the only evil Abraham Ravenwood done?"
Aunt Prue backed away from the book. "What do you mean?" 90% of what the sisters said was nonsense, but the other 10% was worth hearing. The sisters were the ones who had told me about my mysterious ancestor, Ethan Carter Waite, who died during the Civil War. Maybe they knew something about Abraham Ravenwood. Aunt Prue shook her head.
"No good can come from talking about him."
But Aunt Mercy could never resist an opportunity to defy her older sister.
"Our granddaddy used to say Abraham Ravenwood played on the wrong side of right and wrong, tempted fate. He was in league with the devil, all right, practicing witchcraft, communing with evil spirits." "Mercy, you stop all that talk."
"Stop what?
Speaking the truth? Don't you drag the truth into this house."
Aunt Prue was flustered. Aunt Mercy looked me straight in the eye.
"But the devil turned on him after Abraham had done his bidding, and when the devil was done with him, Abraham wasn't even a man anymore. He was something else."
As far as the sisters were concerned, every evil deed, deception, or criminal act was the work of the devil, and I wasn't going to try to convince them otherwise, because after what I'd seen Abraham Ravenwood do, I knew he was more than evil. I also knew it had nothing to do with the devil.
"Now you're telling tales, Mercy Lynn, and you best quit before the good Lord strikes you down here in this house on All Souls of All Days. And I don't want to get hit by a stray bolt."
Aunt Prue whacked Aunt Mercy's chair with her cane.
"You don't think this boy knows about the strange goings-on in Gatlin?"
Aunt Grace appeared in the doorway in her own nightmarishly lavender hat. Before I was born, someone made the mistake of telling Aunt Grace lavender was her color, and nearly everything she wore had been disproving it ever since.
"No use in trying to put the milk back in the jug after it's spilt."
Aunt Prue banged her cane on the floor. They were speaking in riddles, like Amma, which meant they knew something. Maybe they didn't know there were casters wandering around in the tunnels below their house, but they knew something.
"Some messes can be cleaned up easier than others. I don't want any part of this one."
Aunt Prue pushed past Aunt Grace as she left the room.
"This ain't a day to be speaking ill of the dead."
Aunt Grace shuffled over toward us. I took her elbow and guided her to the couch. Aunt Mercy waited for the tapping of Aunt Prue's cane to echo down the hall.
"Is she gone? I don't have my hearing aid turned up."
Aunt Grace nodded.
"I think so."
The two of them leaned in as if they were about to give me launch codes for nuclear missiles.
"If I tell you something, you promise not to tell your daddy? 'Cause if you do, we're bound to end up in the home for sure."
She was referring to the Somerville Assisted Seniors House, the seventh circle of hell as far as the sisters were concerned. Aunt Grace nodded in agreement.
"What is it? I won't say anything to my dad, I promise."
"Prudence Jane's wrong."
Aunt Mercy dropped her voice to a whisper.
"Abraham Ravenwood's still around, sure as I'm sitting here today."
I wanted to say they were crazy, two ancient, senile old ladies claiming to see a man, or what most people thought was a man, no one had seen for 100 years.
What do you mean, still around?
I saw him with my own eyes last year, behind the church of all places.
Aunt Mercy fanned herself with her handkerchief, as if she might faint from the thought of it.
After church on Tuesdays, we wait for Thelma out in front, on account of she has to teach Bible study down the way at First Methodist. Anyhow, I let Harlan James out from inside my pocketbook so he could stretch his little legs. You know Prudence Jane makes me carry him. But soon as I set him down, he ran round the back of the church. You know that dog can't mind to save his life.
Aunt Grace shook her head. Aunt Mercy glanced at the door before continuing.
Well, I had to follow him because you know how Prudence Jane is about that dog. So I went round back, and just when I turned the corner to holler for Harlan James, I saw it. Abraham Ravenwood's ghost. Out in the cemetery behind the church. Those progressives at the round church in Charleston got one thing right.
Folks in Charleston said the round church was built that way so the devil couldn't hide in the corners. I never pointed out the obvious, that the devil usually had no problem marching right down the middle aisle as far as some of our local congregations were concerned.
I saw him too, Aunt Grace whispered, and I know it was him, 'cause his picture's on the wall down at the Historical Society where I play rummy with the girls. Right up there in the Founders Circle, on account of the Ravenwoods being the first ones in Gatlin. Abraham Ravenwood, plain as day.
Aunt Mercy shushed her sister. With Aunt Prue out of the room, it was her turn to call the shots.
It was him, all right. He was out there with Silas Ravenwood's boy. Not Macon, the other one, Phineas.
I remembered the name from the Ravenwood family tree. Hunting Phineas Ravenwood.
You mean Hunting?
Nobody called that boy by his given name. They all called him Phineas. It's from the Bible. You know what it means?
She paused dramatically.
Serpent's tongue.
For a second, I held my breath.
There was no mistaking that man's ghost. As the good Lord is my witness, we cleared out of there faster than a cat with its tail on fire. Now, Lord knows I couldn't move like that these days. Not since my complications.
The sisters were crazy, but their brand was usually based in crazy history. There was no way of knowing what version of the truth they were telling, but it was usually a version. Any version of this story was dangerous. I couldn't figure it out. But if I had learned anything this year, it was that sooner or later, I was going to have to. Lucille meowed, scratching at the screen door. Guess she'd heard enough. Harlan James growled from under the couch. For the first time, I wondered what the two of them had seen, hanging around this house for so long. But not every dog was Boo Radley. Sometimes a dog was just a dog. Sometimes a cat was just a cat. Still, I opened the screen door and stuck a red sticker on Lucille's head. June 17th. Keeping. If there was one reliable source of information around here, it was the folks in Gatlin. On a day like today, you didn't have to look too hard to see most everyone from the town in the same half mile. The cemetery was packed by the time we got there, late as usual, thanks to the sisters. Lucille wouldn't get in the Cadillac. Then we had to stop at Gardens of Eden because Aunt Prue wanted to get flowers for all her late husbands, only none of the flowers looked good enough, and when we were finally back in the car, Aunt Mercy wouldn't let me drive over 20 miles an hour. I had been dreading today for months. Now it was here. I trudged up the sloping gravel path of his garden of perpetual peace, pushing Aunt Mercy's wheelchair. Thelma was behind me, with Aunt Prue on one arm and Aunt Grace on the other. Lucille was trailing after them, picking her way through the pebbles, careful to keep her distance. Aunt Mercy's patent leather purse swung on the handle of her wheelchair, jabbing me in the gut every second step. I was already sweating, thinking about that wheelchair getting caught in the thick summer grass. There was a strong possibility Link and I would be doing the fireman's carry. We made it up the rise in time to see Emily preening in her new white halter dress. Every girl got a new dress for All Souls. There were no flip-flops or tank tops, only your scrubbed Sunday best. It was like an extended family reunion, only 10 times over because pretty much the whole town, and for the most part the whole county, was in one way or another related to you, your neighbor, or your neighbor's neighbor. Emily was giggling and hanging all over Emery.
"Did you bring any beer?"
Emery opened his jacket, revealing a silver flask.
"Better than that."
Eden, Charlotte, and Savannah were holding court near the Snow family plot, which enjoyed a prime location in the center of the rows of headstones. It was covered with bright plastic flowers and cherubs. There was even a little plastic fawn nibbling grass next to the tallest headstone. Decorating graves was another one of Gatlin's contests, a way to prove that you and your family members, even the dead ones, were better than your neighbors and theirs. People went all out. Plastic wreaths wrapped in green nylon vines, shiny rabbits and squirrels, even bird baths, so hot from the sun they could burn the skin right off your fingers. There was no overdoing it. The tackier, the better. My mom used to laugh about her favorites.
"They are still lifes, works of art like the ones painted by the Dutch and Flemish masters, only these are made of plastic. The sentiment's the same."
My mom could laugh at the worst of Gatlin's traditions and respect the best of them. Maybe that's how she survived around here. She was particularly partial to the glow-in-the-dark crosses that lit up at night. Some summer evenings, the two of us would lie on the hill in the cemetery and watch them light up at dusk as if they were stars. Once I asked her why she liked to lie out there.
"This is history, Ethan. The history of families. The people they loved, the ones they lost. Those crosses, those silly plastic flowers and animals, they were put there to remind us of someone who is missed. Which is a beautiful thing to see. And it's our job to see it."
We never told my dad about those nights in the cemetery. It was one of those things we did alone. I would have to walk past most of Jackson High and step over a plastic rabbit or two to get to the Waite family plot on the outskirts of the lawn. That was the other thing about All Souls. There wasn't actually much remembering involved. In another hour, everyone over 21 would be standing around gossiping about the living right after they finished gossiping about the dead, and everyone under 30 would be getting wasted behind the mausoleums. Everyone but me. I'd be too busy remembering.
"Hey, man,"
Link jogged up alongside me and smiled at the sisters.
"Afternoon, ma'ams."
"How are you today, Wesley? You're growing like a weed, aren't you?"
Aunt Prue was huffing and sweating.
"Yes, ma'am."
Rosalie Watkins was standing behind Link, waving at Aunt Prue.
"Ethan, why don't you go on with Wesley? I see Rosalie, and I need to ask her what kind of flour she uses in her hummingbird cake."
Aunt Prue dug her cane into the grass, and Thelma helped Aunt Mercy out of her wheelchair.
"You sure you'll be all right?"
Aunt Prue scowled at me.
"Course we'll be all right. We've been looking after ourselves since before you were born." "Since before your daddy was born,"
Aunt Grace corrected.
"I almost forgot."
Aunt Prue opened her pocketbook and fished something out.
"Found that darned cat's tag."
She looked down at Lucille disapprovingly.
"Not that it helped us any. Not like some people care about years of loyalty and all those walks on your very own clothesline. I reckon it doesn't buy you a drop of gratitude when it comes to some people."
The cat wandered away without so much as a look back. I looked at the metal tag with Lucille's name etched into it and slipped it in my pocket. "The ring is missing."
"Best put it in your wallet, in case you have to prove she doesn't have rabies. She's a biter. Thelma'll see about fetching another one."
"Thanks." The sisters linked arms, and those three gargantuan hats knocked up against each other as they shuffled toward their friends. Even the sisters had friends. My life sucked.
"Sean and Earl brought some beer and Jim Beam. Everyone's meeting behind the Honeycutt crypt."
At least I had Link. We both knew I wouldn't be getting drunk anywhere. In a few minutes, I would be standing over my dead mother's grave. I'd be thinking about the way she always laughed when I told her about Mr. Lee and his twisted version of U.S. history, or U.S. hysteria, as she called it. How she and my dad danced to James Taylor in our kitchen in bare feet. How she knew exactly what to say when everything was going wrong. Like when my ex-girlfriend would rather be with some kind of mutant supernatural than with me. Link put his hand on my shoulder.
"You okay?"
"Yeah, I'm fine. Let's walk around." I would be standing over her grave today. But I wasn't ready. Not yet.
"Hell, where are?"
I caught myself and tried to pull my mind away. I don't know why I still reached for her. Habit, I guess. But instead of Lena's voice, I heard Savannah's. She stood in front of me, wearing way too much makeup, but somehow still managing to look pretty. She was all glossy hair and gloppy eyelashes, and tied up little straps on her sundress that were probably only there to make a guy think about untying them. I mean, if you didn't know what a bitch she was, or didn't care.
"I'm real sorry about your mama, Ethan."
She cleared her throat awkwardly. Her mother probably made her come over here, pillar of the community that Mrs. Snow was. Tonight, though it was barely over a year since my mom died, I'd find more than one casserole on our doorstep, just like the day after her funeral. Time passed slowly in Gatlin, kind of like dog years, only in reverse. And like the day after the funeral, Amma would leave every one of them out there for the possums. Seems possums never get tired of ham and apple casserole. It was still the nicest thing Savannah had said to me since September. Even though I didn't care what she thought of me, today it was nice to have one less thing to feel like crap about. Thanks. Savannah smiled her fake smile and walked off, her high heels jerking as they got stuck in the grass. Link loosened his tie, which was crooked and too short. I recognized it from sixth grade graduation. Underneath it, he had snuck out of the house wearing a t-shirt that said, "I'm with Stupid," with arrows pointing in all different directions. It pretty much summed up how I was feeling today, too. surrounded by stupid. The hits kept on coming. Maybe folks were feeling guilty because I had a crazy father and a dead mother. More likely, they were scared of Amma. Anyway, I must have surpassed Loretta West, a three-time widow whose last husband died after a gator bit a hole in his stomach, as the most pathetic person at All Souls. If they gave out prizes, I would have won the blue ribbon. I could tell by the way folks